Let's focus on the swinging 60s. Not the 1860s, not the 1760s, not the 2060s, but the 1960s. If you can cast your mind back to the angry young men and look back in anger, and one of the movies I actually referred to there was Billy Liar. And at the end of Billy Liar, originally written by Keith Waterhouse, the whole essence of that whole narrative was that Billy Liar remained in the North, remained in the working class North of that wonderful new wave, but his girlfriend actually got on the train to London. And in a real sense, you could argue that that was when the 60s arrived and began to spread. Symbolic of the British film industry in its own particular niche at the time. And the British film industry had, by the time we get to the 1960s, pretty much been in terminal decline. The new wave films that we considered, such as Look Back in Anger and Billy Liar, Saturday Night, Sunday Morning, Loneliness of the Long Distance Runner, they didn't really help that much because although, as we've seen, they were appreciated critically as wonderful snapshots of real, genuine, or working-class British culture, albeit white British culture, they were too depressing, they were too miserable. They couldn't really compete with the Hollywood product. But then we managed to find something that we were good at. Horror. Now, horror had had a long history of success, going way back to Nosferatu and the silent era, and then the Universal movies of 1930s, Frankenstein, Dracula, Frankenstein the Wolfman, The Mummy, and so on. But one of the key things here was that a British studios called Hammer Studios gained the rights to remake a series of Universal horror films that had been put out in the 1930s, the aforementioned Frankenstein, Dracula, and so on. Big difference, this was in colour. As you can actually see there, the general line of the terrifying lover who died yet lived. It's an adult fairy tale. It's escapism. gradually they became more and more successful. And after, obviously, the caveats, don't dare see it alone. Clearly it's a date movie. You can move into a whole range of other hyperbole in terms of shock images and so on. The evil of Frankenstein, which you could say on one level was also kind of reflecting the kind of culture of the time. It's often been said that horror films in general reflect the culture that they're in. They frequently emerge in times of social stress. They tend to be cyclical. We see in the sort of 70s the kind of stalk and slash horror system, the elements that come through on a regular basis. They sort of reflect on some level the notion of how they developed. And both Frankenstein, Dracula, Hammer Horror, Curse of Frankenstein, the Brides of Dracula and so on, they became much more successful. And by the 1960s, they'd effectively reached cult status. So again, let's ask that question, why were they so popular? You know, why in an era where you were actually seeing racism, sexism, Vietnam, other things happening, did they prove to be so popular? Well, they were escapists, as I said. They were sexually permissive. They were also stylish fantasies at their heart about people who did what they liked and weren't too concerned about the larger world issues. The protagonists, be they Baron von Frankenstein or indeed Dracula and his Van Helsing nemesis and so on, were generally out to satisfy their own needs and desires, and broadly speaking that would fit in with the outlook of the young. Top 60s films across the generations, of course, bearing in mind that you had to be over 18 before you could actually go and see a Hammer Horror movie, not surprisingly. Address this whole sort of issue, why did London actually continue to emerge and develop within that? And there is number one of the three major British exports that really focus on in the 60s. I'm not going to talk too much about the second one, Matt Munro. You can find out about his wonderful musical career, but I do want to focus very much on the Bond phenomenon. And it was one of the series of top earning 1960s films across the generations. You know, basically, usually the equivalent of an A certificate or a 12 certificate, 12A and so on. Started off with the one you can actually see there, Dr. No, a variety of other elements within that. It's in colour. It's echoing a whole range of elements within that. It's got attractive women. It's got first James Bond movie. It's tapping into the Cold War ethos of the time. And it's certainly one of those areas which fulfills the whole notion of escapism. But is it a British film? Well, yes, it had British production values. Terence Young, the director, was British. It had a British film crew. And it was led by Sean Connery, obviously a Scotsman. So, you know, British personifications there in terms of the starring roles. But Harry Saltzman and Albert Broccoli, Cubby Broccoli, of course, as he was known, whose family actually did it, or were responsible for bringing the vegetable broccoli to America, although they're of Italian descent, they effectively had to purchase the rights to James Bond. And if you recall, one of the things that Harry Saltzman had produced was Look Back in Anger. So again, he was looking at developing a hit. It's the film industry. Ultimately, if you're not getting lots of people going to see your movie and purchasing tickets and so on, it's not going to be a success. And Bond clearly was a success. It was a product which Ian Fleming had actually developed in the 1950s. It was certainly a very successful, popular novelised series. And again, it tapped into the general feelings of the Cold War at the time. But ultimately, Broccoli and Saltzman couldn't actually make it on their own money. They relied on American capital and American investors. So ultimately, James Bond is a British-American hybrid. Of course, the catch being that the Americans obviously got the profits. Britain, in essence, couldn't compete with American film because it lacked any state backing. Ultimately, the government weren't interested in actually supporting British film, as indeed the French government were and so on, so there wasn't any money available. So the only way you could actually get these large-scale production values was to look for overseas co-producers and investors. The Bond movies were iconic. The whole package was built around the whole notion of success. American consumerism, remember, is in full flow. James Bond, arguably, is the ultimate male consumer. He wears expensive designer clothes. He jets from exotic location to exotic location. Engages in narratives which are full of spectacular prop plots, promiscuous, glamorous 60s women. He drinks martinis, eats gourmet food. What's not to love? In a culture that's increasingly occupied by materialism, worldly success, and sex, Bond arguably is the ultimate expression of the consumerist fantasy. And people couldn't get enough of him. They flocked to the cinema. These were major successful blockbusters. To the extent that in the sequel, as you can see there, the whole notion of James Bond is back with Italian actress Daniela Bianchi and the lead role of Tatiana Romanova, the Russian Soviet agent that is key to the whole plot, etc. We see this whole essence of, you know, male fantasy and arguably as a human fantasy at its heart. Harry Saltzman, who was the Canadian producer responsible for the Bond films, as we mentioned, also went on to make a series of films that were based on novels by Len Dayton. This was about a spy called Harry Palmer. This was the first of them, starred a young Michael Caine, again, very much at the heart of this whole 60s swing culture. The other novels about Harry Palmer were Funeral in Berlin and Billion Dollar Brain. Now, ultimately, though, that particular trilogy feels more British. Michael Caine portraying Harry Palmer is more of a kind of British-type gumshoe hero. But again, there are surreal movements, surreal movies that are actually there, and tie into the television sort of aspect of the time, the Avengers, and equally had a number of interesting psychedelic moments that we'll also go on to consider in terms of pop culture. And although Caine was a success as Harry Palmer in the Len Dayton trilogy, ultimately his major role, the one that kind of launched him, was that. This is the one that effectively put Michael Caine into the role of being a 1960s icon. Emerged and produced in 1966, when England were top of the World Cup football tree, and it was a British film that basically was about sex and permissiveness among the young. So clearly it's tapping into, again, the fantasy, the male-based fantasy that we actually got at the time, and, as hopefully we'll see from this particular clip, as opposed to the later remake by Jude Law, it's opening up the whole notion of how we kind of perceive, or are asked to perceive, the whole Michael Caine character, and indeed the lavishness of the image.
Get your knee on the steering wheel!
I can't, I'm stuck!
Here, look at it, I'll do it.
Oh!
Well, you certainly
can.
Now, look, I'm
going to
take the wheel off and I'm going
to
tell you how to Right, where you begin? My name is...
Alfie.
Alfie, bubbles with impudent humour and ripe modern wit, says the New York Times.
I was having a beautiful little life. There was this manageress of a dry cleaner's. And I was getting a suit cleaned in the bargain.
Everybody's running after Alfie.
What can I say when you ask? You shouldn't ask, you know. I'll tell you when I feel like it.
Would you like me to give you something to make you sleep?
Now, there's a good idea.
Come with me.
Michael Caine gives a brilliant performance, says Red Book magazine. Is Alfie really as good as all that?
Now, what's the ticket about?
Shelley Winters thinks so.
Now, what's your address?
Alfie returns the compliment.
She's in lovely condition.
Condition is everything in life.
I'll just get you ready for your injection, Mr. Elkins.
Oh, thank you, nurse.
The New York Daily News gives Alfie 4 stars and says that people are going to stop talking about Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf and start talking about Alfie.
Oh, what are you so impatient about?
Alfie, a delightful comedy. A direct hit. presented in the best of humor and with complete frankness, says the New York Post. Michael Caine is superb, says the Saturday Review. Alfie, you might say, has it been?
Alfie, what's it all about? Alfie, is it just for the moment we live?
As Life magazine puts it, you are going to enjoy Alfie very much.
Obviously recommended for mature audiences. The director of Alfie, Lewis Gilbert, also went on to direct You Only Live Twice and The Spy Who Loved Me and Moonraker in the Bond series. So clearly you're seeing a connection of uses as far as that's actually concerned. But, again, if we go back to considering the wonderment that is Alfie and break it down into sort of key areas, Alfie's goal is sex. He can't make relationships. He isn't interested in anything except promiscuity, how many girls he can actually add to notches on his bedpost, and in the end, he's actually left with nothing. It's ultimately seen as a somewhat strange account of a new wave protagonist in a counterculture setting. That final message, as we actually heard on the soundtrack there, what's it all about, Alfie, is possibly one of those moments of reflecting on the futility of life, the existentialism, something which previously had kind of only been done mostly by French cinema and so on. You know, ultimately, Alfie is seen as somebody who has money, he's got affluence, he's a consumer, and yet he's not happy. It won an award at the Cannes Film Festival, it had several Academy Award nominations, but it also put Michael Caine on the international stage. We launched the session today with a short clip from the introduction to Georgie Girl, if only to actually leave it as a meme that you'll be humming for the rest of the day. But in this particular case, a good-looking but shallow 1960s girl, played by Charlotte Rampling, had a promiscuous lifestyle. She had a baby. She abandoned her child to a plain and plump flatmate that we saw in the opening clip there, Lynn Redgrave. Why? So she could actually go back to living a hedonistic 1960s lifestyle. So the idea that was being promulgated within the cinema at the time was effectively, if you happen to have an unfortunate accident and get pregnant, well, we can still deal with that. A whole range of other issues to be fore, and ultimately the key thing was to have fun. A movie called Accident, which was scripted by Harold Pinter and starred Dirk Bogarde. You may recall he sort of emerged when we were talking about dramatic sort of storylines earlier. That focused on self-centred people who didn't take any responsibility for any damage that they actually did. As you can see, music by, sung in the film by The Seekers, Georgie Girl, and so on from there. In terms of avant-garde cinema, and beginning to dip into the notion of the latter part of the 60s, this particular movie, Blow Up, starred David Hemmings, who was a very, very successful photographer, and was based on the real-life fashion photographer, David Bailey. It conveys the glamorous world of what was seen as swinging London. It had a range of beautiful people, it featured nudity, it featured Vanessa Redgrave, it featured a whole range of folk, and it basically showed people really trying to come to terms with a sensational fueled world in which they lived, in which they existed, and in which effectively they carried out their activities.
Sometimes reality is the strangest fantasy of all. Today. You are an eyewitness to what's happening in a world where the beautiful and the bizarre take on new forms and hold new fascinations.
So what better endorsement could you possibly have for Britain actually being at the heart of real top where it's at culture than having an Italian film director from the land where you're into real classic emotional films, La Dolce Vita and so on, and to actually have that with British actors developing obviously racy, dramatic movies about photography and styles. And even in that particular clip we could actually see a glimpse of the protest movement against Vietnam at the time. Well, again, the year was 1966 and it focused on the whole notion of this sensational world, which was all of London, obviously. It wasn't anywhere else in the country as yet, but it certainly was permeating from the capital city, the sort of messages that we were seeing there and being developed. Although ultimately, Blow Up was produced in Britain by an American studio. And when the Americans actually pulled out of London and the British film industry, effectively, the British film industry at the time almost collapsed. Did kind of pick up again, still kind of keeps going after a fashion. But nevertheless, as far as film was concerned, with Bond, with Hammer, with Carry On movies, with a variety of other contexts, certainly Britain was back on the film culture map and it was competing in the wider world. Which brings us to this young lady here. Because this is also a time where the British fashion industry begins to show signs of life. As teenagers were increasingly consuming clothes, stylistic clothes, etc., fashion was inevitably becoming big business in both America and in Europe. And there were three major British designers of the period who were very important in the international stage. The first one, she's up there now. Anybody know who this person is? Clue, she designed the miniskirt. Mary Quant, Quant. She trained at the University of London, and she opened a boutique in the King's Road, actually, in 1955. Actually, if you say she definitely invented the miniskirt, it is open to debate, but she did undoubtedly popularise it. She also popularised the notion of having androgynous skinny models, especially Twiggy, and we'll see in a few moments, pinafore dresses, skinny rib sweaters, white collars, all a look which is stylistically very identifiable. This young lady was a Polish immigrant. Her name, Barbara Hulaniki. Barbara Hulaniki, H-U-L-A-N-I-K-I, was a Polish immigrant who studied design at Brighton School of Art. We're beginning to see the whole notion of the art culture world developing. And what she effectively started doing was to sell her clothes through mail order. She founded the company Biba in 1964. Biba became a huge shop on the High Street, Kensington. And it sold everything from tie-dye t-shirts to feather boas to makeup to velvet trousers. It was a lavish place and formerly was a design shop which attracted the famous and the beautiful people. It stayed open until 1976. And then finally, together with Barbara Hulaniki and Mary Quant and the fashion scene, came this gentleman, Ozzie Clarke. Ozzie Clarke was so successful in the mid-1960s that his designs actually were bestsellers in New York. He was the first British clothes designer who had any impact in Europe and America. And inevitably, he lived the hedonistic lifestyle to the full. He dressed the rich and famous. He regularly took drugs. Sadly, his career declined in the 1970s, and the drug addiction impacted, together with bankruptcies. There were various comebacks, And then finally, he was stabbed to death by his lover in 1996. The other noteworthy British fashion designers at a time were, as I say, prior to this, the British had no sense of fashion. We wore, you know, Brian in town and, you know, countryside tweeds, and that's basically it. There wasn't a great deal. Oh, flat caps and whippets if you're in the north. So this was clearly a sort of notion where culturally the stylish aspect, which previously had been the domain of Paris and Milan and New York, was changing. There was a shift in terms of what looks people were looking to take part in. John Stephen was another fashion designer who came from Glasgow. John Stephen created Carnaby Street, that whole essence of Carnaby Street as the fashionable centre of the world. He opened a string of boutiques, which again was designed to cater for the young who were seeking trendy fashions. And Carnaby Street became as famous in its own way as King's Road, Chelsea, leading John Stephen to make a fortune. Now, Britain was also even better known for exporting models. Jean Shrimpton and Twiggy became world famous. They actually made substantial sums of money. Ultimately, yes, it was always going to be a battle to compete with the great European and American fashion houses. But for a while, in these swinging 60s, as they were coined, Britain was very much one of the places to be. Although arguably more important than film and fashion put together was what's often considered by critics as being the greatest British merchandising opportunity of the 1960s. Four blokes from Liverpool, the Beatles. By 1963, the Beatles were the preeminent youth band in Britain. By September 1963, She Loves You, Please Please Me, and Twist and Shout were all in the charts. And in October, they were booked to appear on the hugely successful television programme Sunday Night at the London Palladium. That was the top-rated ITV variety show. That event in itself got front-page coverage. In other words, teenage culture had finally made it to the mainstream of British life. According to the Daily Mirror at the time, 60 police fought to hold back 1,000 screaming fans on the pavement outside when the Beatles turned up in London, at the London Palladium. But actually, when you look at the photographic archives, and a picture in the Mail actually showed that rather than 60 police fighting to hold back 1,000 screaming fans, there was one policeman and three girls. Go figure. Where's the hype? Where's the truth? Or whatever, this was the beginnings of what became Beatlemania. In November of 63, a couple of months later, the Beatles appeared at the Royal Variety Command Performance, an annual event, as now. This time, there were thousands of screaming fans, and there were 500 additional police who were drafted in. 26 million people watched the programme. 26 million people watching the Beatles at the Royal Variety Command Performance. That is a significant audience. That's a massive way in which we see, and we'll go on to see in terms of seminars, the impact in terms of Beatlemania as an export. Now, it's fair to say not everybody admires the Beatles. Many people thought that they represented the ugly face of an affluent, consumer-led culture. After all, they had long hair, and they had provincial accents. They actually sounded foreign. Good grief, Scouristown, from Liverpool. Their manager, Brian Epstein, was seen as grasping. It was all about the money, it was all about commercialism. And in many ways, the public appearances of the Beatles reminded folk of Nuremberg rallies. Again, this is 30 years after Nuremberg rallies, 20 years after the Second World War. So it's still within living memories of when you get huge numbers of people gathering together, screaming in a kind of collective hysteria over their objects of adulation, there's something not quite right about that. Large crowds of historical girls who didn't seem to be able to think for themselves. They screamed mindlessly over lyrics such as, "Love, love me do, you know I love you, I'll always be true, so please love me do." Ultimately, it didn't really seem to be about the culture. It's about adolescence. It's about hormones. It's about sexual attraction. And there's also plenty of money to be made out of this new media-driven phenomenon. It's opening up the whole sort of culture of the Beatles in terms of their particular place. In other words, you're getting this wonderful, perfect storm. You're getting, and you could actually throw into the mix, conceivably, the notions that, as I say, for one glorious moment in 66, England became world champions in terms of football. Not quite resonated by the 2003 Rugby World Cup, but at the same time, there was that kind of connection. And for the combination of the stylistic approach of the Bond movies, the colour impacts that's there, the fantasies that are being promulgated in terms of television, shows like The Avengers, American imports that are coming through, exporting spy-fi and various other sort of elements, the technological space race that we're seeing. There's a lot of exciting elements coming through within this whole notion. And you've also got, as we've seen, young people, teenagers with greater access to money than ever before, but ultimately a whole core buying market and an audience who are relatively easy to manipulate. Easy targets for any phenomenon which is driven primarily by mass advertising and peer pressure. If you don't like the Beatles, you must like the Rolling Stones. If you don't like the Rolling Stones, you must like the Kings. If you don't like any of them, you must be really boring. And so on and so forth. But the whole range of sort of elements coming through within this. There were huge quantities of Beatle merchandise that became available as industry cashed in. You could get Beatles clothes. One of the key things that Brian Epstein actually did was he put the Beatles in suits. Before that, they performed in Hamburg, they'd gone on European tours, they had an extensive time in Germany, as well as obviously in the Cavern Club in Liverpool, but they were dressed very much in the icons or the classic notions of American rock and rollers. You know, leather jackets, unkempt, greased back hair and so on. Epstein changed them, gave them an image remake, put them in suits, tightened them up, suddenly actually made them more wacky, zany, mop-top culture. You could have Beatle wigs, you could have Beatle models, Beatle posters, Beatles bed linen, and of course Beatles fanzines. Critics would argue that the culture was ultimately being replaced by a craze for consumption. It wasn't the actual music themselves, it was the fact that they wanted to be part of something, that they wanted to actually have the images, have the posters, have the records, have the books, have the magazines, have the clothes, etc., without really understanding what it was they were getting into, what people were purchasing. And you could arguably say similar things were carried through by popular television programs at the time. Why do we still have 50-year anniversary celebrations of Thunderbirds, Captain Scarlet, the sort of the teenage sort of Star Trek and so on? Tapping into that sort of cultural area. We now look back in many cases in a nostalgic perspective, but at the same time you're still buying stuff to actually work through this. Gratification, in other words, if we're looking at a gratification theory, wasn't about getting to grips with a difficult new musical or art form and trying to work out what the composer is saying and how they're developing, etc. It wasn't about deepening your perceptions of understanding. It was basically about changing your hairstyle and buying a record, as we saw in the opening sort of scenes from Georgie Girl. You know, shall I go for that wig? Shall I go for that wig? Shall I change that? No, I'll go for that, etc. Ultimately, a kind of fairly shallow existence, you might well say. There's no doubt that the Beatles would sell records and continue to sell records. For every person who bought a Beatles record, however, there were 50 people who didn't. And it's fair to say that in the 60s, the Beatles were predominantly a teenage phenomenon. But phenomenon, which can be a difficult word to spell and pronounce, is certainly something which is worth applying when we consider the Beatles. Because they did sell far more records than their competitors. Bands like the Rolling Stones, bands like the Yardbirds with Eric Clapton, bands like the Kinks. The other interesting fact, of course, is all of these bands are British. Capitol Records aggressively marketed the Beatles, and by the end of 1963, in terms of marketing, they had effectively conquered Britain. Where do you go to after you've conquered the British market? Well, you go overseas. And ideally, you go to the much larger American market. Beatlemania hit America in February 1964. Again, a little bit of a perfect storm. only a matter of 3 months after President Kennedy had been assassinated in November 1963. A young president, a dynamic president, a president who's pointed the way to the future, a president who is destined, obviously, to leave a legacy of the Vietnam War and, of course, have to deal with the situation with the Cuban Missile Crisis, but also launch in full force the space race and inspired the notion of putting humanity on the moon, but nevertheless a presidency that had been part of this Arthurian dream, this notion of Kennedy as King Arthur with his Camelot, and suddenly assassinated, taken away from the American people, a time when, in many ways, America lost its innocence, and after the period of mourning was, in many ways, ripe to possibly have a new dynamic youthful influence on them. The one thing is that the Beatles could actually do in spades, as we'll see when we look at some clips that are developed from their sort of visits to America, is they could actually come across as being very charming, very sophisticated, very wacky, but youthful. After a brief visit in February 1964, the band returned for a major tour later in 64, and again they triumphed. Sell-out performances. America had plenty of its own bands, but the Beatles did make a significant impact, and they made huge sums of money. And although they were quickly followed by the Rolling Stones, and the Yardbirds, and the Kinks, they never really succeeded as strongly as the Beatles in the American marketplace. Neither did Cliff Richard and the Shadows. Somehow the Beatles had the magic touch. Somehow they also opened the door to marketing British youth culture abroad. So, again, let's attempt to dig down a little bit in terms of this. Let's find out where and how the Beatles actually emerged. Well, apart from Liverpool, obviously. John Lennon and Paul McCartney were obviously the songwriters, and they were the driving forces in the band. But was the work of the Beatles as empty of culture and meaning as some critics have argued? And again, it's a polarisation. In the journey of 7 or 8 years that they existed as a band, at the top of their game, from 63 to 69, 70, etc., there are key things to consider. First of all, the gap between high culture and commerce began to disappear in the 1960s. The accepted wisdom that if you wanted to be taken seriously as an artist, you had to die, and then effectively what was left would be considered and poured over, and people would say, this is fantastic what Picasso was doing. This is really meaningful material. That was beginning to go, you know, understandably, people were saying, I'd quite like to actually have my success and rewards here as well as, you know, in the afterlife, thank you very much. And artists like Andy Warhol in America, and in Britain, Peter Blake and Richard Hamilton, were quite happy to use their work commercially. We were getting away from this notion that saw getting involved with things like the advertising culture and making money was somehow not good. Almost a kind of British holdover, really, you might well say. Both Richard Hamilton and Peter Blake created famous album covers. In Blake's case, the Sgt. Pepper cover was created by him. And in essence, they also produced a variety of throwaway art, which involved with respect to advertisements. The Andy Warhol Campbell's soup montage, for instance. I mentioned David Bailey earlier in context of the movie that was about him and his work, Blow Up, but he would regularly photograph celebrities for glossy magazines. And equally, jazz as a form was beginning to bridge the gap in music between the highbrow and the lowbrow. So again, you're not getting that split between, oh, this is high culture, this is low culture. You're getting a gradual mingling, a hybridization of cultures at work. Also, as we've said earlier in the module, as part of the expansion of education, art schools had multiplied. And the Arts Council agenda was about promoting new, young, contemporary artists. The sort of artists who would actually study at art schools. And part of the process of the curriculum in an art school was not to actually really worry about the merits of the art, but basically have the opportunity to study art regardless of your social class. So you didn't have that elitist notion which said, oh, I'm sorry, you can't study the works of the French Impressionists because you went to a comprehensive school. Why not? There's a kind of breaking down of barriers and a breaking down of the potential inspirational areas that are actually there. In other words, there was also a political, social policy agenda that was opening up a whole range of other areas. And as we said, statement that I put there, you have this combination of art, both literal art in terms of canvases in art galleries and so on, but also throwaway art in terms of advertisements, cultures, posters and so on, fashion, photography, music and film, would all combine to effectively create and sell a lifestyle. A lifestyle which people would aspire to. Just as actually the Americans had done in the 1950s. Because exactly the same model was used to kind of synthesize that consumer-driven, success-based society. It's just Britain had kind of needed about 10 years to get up to that stage because it was rebuilding after the Second World War. And that art school element is where many of the most iconic pop stars actually emerged from. John Lennon and Paul McCartney, obviously. George Harrison, Ringo Starr later. Eric Clapton, the guitarist with the Yardbirds. Pete Townsend from The Who. Ray Davies from The Kinks. Eric Burdon from The Animals. Viv Stanshall, the Bonzo Dog Doo-Dah Band. All of them emerged from that whole concept. That then led to this whole notion of what we would consider as pop art. And when we actually start considering pop art, I also like to say, let's go back to the Beatles and let's consider the notion of Yellow Submarine, which I'm sure you've all actually heard of, but the Yellow Submarine movie, which is a perfect example of slightly surreal material.
Nothing is real. The Beatles. Yellow Submarine. Artwork, photography, landscapes painted with Beatles sound.
Picture yourself in a boat on a river with tangerine trees and marmalade skies.
We all live in a yellow submarine.
The Yellow Submarine.
Yellow Submarine.
The forces of good. The Beatles. The Boob.
I must complete my task. Two novels, finish my blueprints, begin my begin.
Hey, Jeremy, must you always talk in rhyme?
And if I spoke prose, you'd all pile out. I don't know what I talk about.
He's a real nowhere man, sitting in his nowhere land.
The forces of evil, Robin, the butterfly stomper, snapping turtle turks, the apple bonkers, the terrible flying glove, the arch villain, the blue meanie.
We are the original.
Sighted within the vicinity of this theatre. Oh, there's only one way to go out.
How's that?
Singing! One, two, three,
four!
part there. Well, according to Richard Hamilton, in the White Album, it actually started as early as 1957. Pop art, he defined it as being popular, obviously, transient, expendable, low cost, mass produced, young, witty, sexy, gimmicky, and glamorous. It was very saleable, very now. It was throwaway culture. Actually, you can go back to the 1930s America, when pop art began to emerge. An artist called Thomas Hart Benton began to seek advertising commissions, and to him, a truly public artist was somebody who should reach a wide public. There was this idea that if art and corporations came together, in the same way that social science and corporations had come together, art would contribute to reforming corporate attitudes, the Blue Meanies. In the same way, sociology and economics would also kind of contribute to a better world. A world in which we could all live into a yellow submarine and press a button. Or Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds is not to be confused with another LSD side of things. It was a very progressive idea, and it seemed to offer a solution in terms of how you could actually find a place for art in American life again in the 1930s. But in practice, the ideas didn't work out. Hollywood in 1937 was a period when it was becoming unionised and it was battling the industry to improve workers' rights. There were a whole range of other issues that were actually there. And Benton's work never quite managed to emerge within America. But when effectively he came on board to develop various other aspects within Britain, there was an opportunity to open up this whole advertising mainstream culture, an advertising world in which things could be developed and worked through as real icons of the 20th century, where nothing might be real, or it's all in your mind. Andy Warhol, considered by many to be the most influential American artist of the second half of the 20th century, used commercial silkscreen techniques to create identical mass-produced images on canvas. Warhol's subjects were consumerist, they reflected popular culture, Marilyn Monroe, and so on. Everything from Coke bottles to celebrities were being used, and also it was affordable. Anybody could afford to buy your own art form. Comic books were graphic narratives. The work of Steranko, the work of Stan Lee, Jack Kirby, they all became associated with pop art culture. In other words, art had become a product for mass consumption that reflected the new myth and mythologies and ideologies of the age. And pop art itself became emblematic. It drove a thriving market of art dealers and art galleries. It was criticised, again, because it fully supported affluent consumerism and actually didn't really seem to have any other messages. It was boring, it was shallow on one hand, but maybe that's an age thing. Art had become democratised and more people had access to it by designing it and by living with it than ever before. And again, into this mix, as far as Britain's concerned, Terence Conran, C-O-N-R-A-N, opened the first Habitat store in Fulham Road in Chelsea. Why? Well, to market his own range of modern designer furniture. And he would sell everything that you needed to live in a modern designer apartment. Furniture, kitchen equipment, lamps. In fact, of all of those, the most successful of the Conrad aspects of Habitat was a jar designed to actually hold pasta. So you never quite know what's actually going to be the popular sort of end of the whole system. People, again, criticise this whole notion of ephemeral aspects, tastes as well, as we saw in terms of the whole aspects of bands like the Beatles. Were they actually doing anything socially relevant? Again, we'll go on to consider this in seminars and probably next week. Or were they actually just interested in making money? That's what I want, as the Flying Lizards once said. I want your money. But what's wrong with that? The country in Britain in this period was affluent. It was the place which had a swinging culture. And many people were actually having a great time chasing the fashions. Not all, but many people. But nevertheless, as we already saw last week in terms of the race issue, there was still dissatisfaction behind the scenes. Vietnam was rumbling on. And in America, there was an increasingly social and vocal breakdown in a consensus about civil rights issues. What we'll be looking at next week again, addressing that particular question there, in terms of the pop culture, is the growth of the protest movement in Europe, and also how some of the pop stars and folk we talked about today and introduced and reintroduced to you also had their beginnings of statements and things to work through. That's it. Make sure you've signed the register, and I'll see you in seminars later on today or on Monday.